Okay, thank you very much. All right, so this is an outline of the talk. So I'm going to start off by introducing the subject and trying to say what our basic philosophy is and what we're trying to do. And we're going to try to grow multi-species communities. And so what we're going to try to do is to construct dynamically food webs. So one of the things I have to do is tell you what food webs are, because I don't think they've really come up in this program so far. Okay, and they're also going to be the subject of the next talk. So I'll spend the second section talking about food webs. Then in section 3 and 4, I'll talk about the dynamics of the model itself. So I'll describe our model. Okay, and then section 5 will be just devoted to the results. And then I'll talk about usual thing, conclusions, and what we can do in the future. So here are the people who've been involved in this project, which has taken place at the University of Manchester. So actually the majority of the people are in this room. Okay, so Barbara and Paul are both here. Guido is now a postdoc in Rome, and he was involved in the early part of the work. And Chris is a graduate student in Manchester. And there's sort of two versions of the model. Okay, we had the first stab at it here. All right, and the basic ideas are there, but the population dynamics aspect was a little bit simple-minded. And so later on, we came back to it and have a far more sophisticated form of the population dynamic equations. And there's also a recent version, a recent paper, which is to appear in the proceedings of the Dresden conference, which took place last year. Okay, and so all of these are on the archive. So, what's the basic aim? Okay. So what we want to do is we actually want to construct food webs. Okay. And so food webs, for the purposes of the first bit of the talk, anyway, are just sets of predator-prey in interactions. Okay. So you imagine that you have a multi-species community, lots of species in there, and you draw all as links the set of predator-prey interactions between them, okay, and the web that's constructed is the food web. Okay, now most people, when they talk about food web in the literature, and if they have a go at trying to do some theoretical models of food webs, tend to take a rather static viewpoint. Okay, they sort of postulate some kind of static food web. Okay, they might postulate the interactions are random, or they might have some kind of connectivity which defines it. But what we want to do, we want to actually evolve it. Okay, so we want to construct it dynamically. All right. So what you want to do is through our population dynamics and also through some evolutionary dynamics, we want to actually grow this thing, starting off from a few species and then doing some speciation and actually building up a community of many species. Okay. So this is obviously going to take a long time. Okay. So this is a question on an evolutionary time scale. Okay, however, in order to study that, we're going to have some realistic population dynamics. And so this is what is studied on an ecological timescale. Okay, so this is the sort of population dynamics that we all know and love, Lotka-Volterra equations and things like that. Okay, so this typically, you have a fixed number of species. Okay, so you don't have speciation or anything like that. With on this time scale, we have speciation. So in order to study this, we need some a realistic population dynamics. Okay, so these two scales are sort of intertwined. Okay, it's not really possible to study this without having a realistic population dynamics. But we also claimed, in order to actually understand food webs today, okay, food webs that are out there, we need to have this evolutionary timescale in there. So these two timescales are intermingled with each other. If we want to model this, we have to model this. Okay, so this is a rough sketch of what's going on. We have time along here. So these purple blobs are speciations. Okay, so we're going to take such a coarse-grained viewpoint here that we're going to have a speciation is just going to be a stochastic process, okay, and we're not going to go into all the details that speciation involves. Now, if we then look at a slightly finer time scale, if we just look at the time scale or the time interval between two speciations, this is where this comes in. Okay, this is population dynamics, and we're going to have some realistic population dynamics which governs this time where you have a fixed number of species. Well, I'll come to that, actually. I'm going to have a detailed description of what a food web is and so on. So let me just reiterate this. Okay, this is going to be our approach. We're going to have population dynamics equations using this tripopulation sizes of species over ecological time. Okay, and then we're going to have these evolutionary time steps, okay, where we have a speciation. So we're going to add a new species to the model. If some species aren't doing very well, they'll go. If some species aren't doing well at all, they'll go extinct, and then we'll go back to this. We'll evolve a system for a while. We'll have another evolutionary time step where we have a speciation and extinction, and we just repeat this many times. Okay. And one of the things that we want to emphasize is that this model can actually be tested against data. Okay. So
that.
Yes.
Species or
coming from around? No, they're evolved. I mean, I'm going to give detailed rules later on, but I'm just trying to motivate what's going on. No, they're going to be there's going to be a speciation. It's going to be one species in the system which will speciate to another similar species. Okay, so we're going to, and as I say, I want to stress that this is going to be, we're going to try to test this against real data that's collected by ecologists in order to try to keep us honest. Okay. Right. Okay, so that's a quick summary of what we want to do. So now, let me just, this is not describing the model, this is just a background to what a food web is. Okay, so this is a kind of child's eye view of what a food web is. Okay, so you have non-living resources, okay, which is the external world. Okay, and you imagine this consists of sunlight and minerals or whatever. Okay, and the input into the food chain. Okay, and right at the bottom are the basal species. So basal species are typically plants which have no prey. Okay, so that's the definition of a basal species. Species which have no prey. There's also could be little thingies like this. Okay, which have no prey. They just extract. Their sustenance from non-living resources. Right at the top are top species. Okay, so these are things with no predators. And then most of the species will be in intermediate. Namely, they'll both have predators and prey. Okay, and so the direction of the arrow here is always indicates that this is the prey of this. Okay, so this you can think of it as this goes into the mouth of this thing. Okay, right. That's an easy way to think about it. And we're also going to talk about levels. Okay, so we're going to talk now. You can see that the concept of a level is a bit ambiguous, right? Because this is level one, you'd think this is level two, and so on. But you might ask, well, is this level one or level two? I mean, this is level zero. Okay, because it's sort of level one if you look at it this way, but it also seems to be level two if you look at it that way. So we always define the level as the shortest path between the species and the non-living world. Okay, so in this case, we'll call this level one, and that's because most of the resources presumably go, as we'll see later on, presumably go through this route rather than this through this intermediate route. So I think that's consistent with what ecologists do. Well, okay. Well, you have to come up with a definition, and I think that's the one that's usually used. I mean, also, I'm going to be talking, when I talk about species, I actually mean trophic species, okay? So trophic species are species which have the same predators and the same prey, okay? So if you have, if you look at two beetles, and they're eaten by the same thing, and they eat the same thing, and they're lumped together as the same species, okay? So this is how things are tabulated.
Can you circle in that scheme,
like young? Yes.
Everybody eat young?
Well, there can be circles, yes, certainly. A eats B, B eats C, and C eats A, yeah, sure. Right, so this is a slightly more grown-up version of the same thing, all right? So So basically, so these are the basal species. Okay, I'm going into this because this is important in actually, these are going to involve some of the parameters of our model and some of the results that we want to compare our model with. So these are the basal species. This is an intermediate species because it has a prey. Okay, it has a prey. And this is a top species because it doesn't have a predator. All right. However, although it's a top species, it's not necessarily in the highest level. So this shows the top species don't really have to be at the top level here. Okay. It's on level two because there's two pathways here. And these two things are trophic species, okay, because they're eaten by the same things, so they eat the same thing. So the dotted line indicates that they're trophic species. So why I wanted to do this is because the things that are normally measured by ecologists involve all these concepts. Okay, so if you look at food webs that are published in the literature, they tabulate the proportion of basal, intermediate, and top species in the web, the proportion of links between the basal, intermediate, basal, and top, and so on, links per species, ratio of prey to predators, number of levels. All these things are things that they measure. And these are things that we would hope to predict in our model and actually compare with what's really out there. So here are two webs. Okay, so this is a desert community in California somewhere, and this is a lake in Wisconsin. Okay, and so. Now, I don't expect there to be any universality in these numbers. Okay, so actually these numbers are pretty close to each other, but you can actually find other food webs where there's some differences. But there are things that we would hope to predict. For example, there tend to be very few top species. Okay, the number of basal species is, usually about 10, 15, 20%, something like that. Okay, and there's other numbers. Like, there's never more than four levels, okay? There might be three levels, but never usually more than four. So there's various kind of rules of thumb that the ecologists have, and these are things that we would hope to predict in our model. So I'll stress again, we're not trying to predict these numbers exactly, right? We don't want to, even as long as the kind of rough trends are there.
How is it in Coachella, the maximum level is three, but there's no top species?
Well, the top species doesn't have to be on the third level.
So
it could be on the second.
By your definition.
Yeah.
How is it? It looks like the total number of species is 29, but there are 90 intermediate.
No, this is a percentage.
Oh, percentage.
Sorry, back to the top question. Is it obvious there is always a top?
No. Well, some of these things are probably, when we see zeros here, this may be 0.4 or something, I think. I'm not sure.
Well, then
you'd have...
Are these things only the key element when they're alive or scavenging?
Oh, no. Well, there's a huge number of problems with actually, deciding what you include in here and what you don't. There's some people include sort of organic matter in their food webs. Some don't. Do include types of, bacteria. I don't know. So this is a debate. There's huge debate in the literature as to, what kind of numbers you can believe and what you should include and what you shouldn't include and so on. Right? So this is a whole topic in itself. Right? That's why I don't want to attach too much meaning to these numbers because there's a lot of debate about this. And also the guy who composed this food web criticized all food webs that I think were published before 1990. As not having sufficient detail in there, okay, and they had far more top species, And then he came along, actually reanalyzed their data and claimed that they had sort of missed some of the weakest links. Now, it's very difficult to collect this stuff. It takes years of effort. I mean, like this lake, you have graduate students camped by the lake for years trying to collect this stuff, and sort of, spend their days sort of jumping in, swimming around and seeing what eats what. I mean, it's not an easy job. Probably a wholesome way to get a PhD, but I mean, it's not. So, this is just meant to be orders of magnitude. Well, look, why don't we defer these questions until we have our model, and then we can show, I can show pictures of webs from our model, and then you'll get a clearer idea of what's going on. And I'll also talk about flow of resources through the web. Okay. Anyway, it's that kind of data that we're trying to predict. Okay. Right. So let's go to the model now. Okay. So the first ingredient must be population dynamics. Now, the problem is, we have spent a lot of time on this because most discussions of population dynamics in the literature focus just on one predator and one prey, and there's just a few predators and a few prey. What we want is the population dynamics for an arbitrary number of predators, an arbitrary number of prey, and things may change from being predators to prey with time, and so, and the links, may go away and so on. So we actually want a very flexible scheme. Okay, and we had to devise our own population dynamics, and that's what took a lot of the time because there wasn't that much in the literature on this. So anyway, let's start off with a very simple example, which is a textbook example. It actually comes from a textbook by Roughgarden on this. Okay, and so this is just one predator and one prey, although I've called it one predator and one victim. Okay, because unfortunately, predator and prey have both the same first letter P. All right, so V is just the population size of victims, predators is the population size of predator, and we have this, what hopefully is a fairly familiar equation. Okay, there's a term here which is the growth rate of the prey population in the absence of predators. So this has both a birth and a death term, okay, and this is just the net growth, okay? And this, you've got to subtract from this the number of victims that are eaten by the predator. Okay, so this is the capturated prey per predator multiplied by the number of predators. Okay, now this is an important quantity. This is called the functional response. Okay, and most of the next two slides will be focused on how can we construct what this is as a function of P and V.
Why is it not linear in V?
There's some P and V dependence in here, but I haven't come to that yet. I'm just trying to, all right, and then here we've got the dP by dt. There's now the rate at which each predator converts captured prey into predator births. So what this is called the numerical response. This is going to be a function of this. And in fact, most people assume that it's proportional to this. Okay, so this is like a kind of birth term for the predators. But what it consists of, you say, you just see how much food, if you like, is eaten by the predators, and then there'll be some fixed percentage of this, which we call lambda, which will be used to create baby predators. All right, so that's the idea. All right, so this, as I say, is in principle this is an independent function of P and V. However, normally it's assumed it's proportional to this. That is, there's a fixed percentage of the resources that are obtained by eating the prey, which are used in creating new predators. Yeah. That seems to be non-controversial amongst ecologists. I mean, it's a simplification, certainly. Okay, and then there's a term at the rate at which predators die in the absence of prey. Okay, so now if you put that in a slightly, this is what I mean. Okay, in terms of the equation. So here's our functional response here. And I've just assumed it's a function of P and V. Okay, there it is again there, but it's multiplied by this lambda, okay, which is the percentage of the food that's used to create new predators. Here's a death rate, D2. And the first term is a birth, a death rate, and also there's a birth rate. Now, this you could just make up perhaps as some linear function of v, but I've also put it in terms of a gene. I imagine that this perhaps is extracting food from the is extracting resources from the environment. So although it's a victim, or it might have a prey itself. Okay, so this is just written down to match this term here. Okay. So you could, if you wanted, just model this by a kind of logistic term, if you wanted. Okay. So, all right. So hopefully you can see how we're going to generalize the equations. It's always going to be a term like this, okay, which comes from, which is proportional to the functional response. There's going to be a death term, and then there'll be a term like this. And if this had some predators, there'd be a similar term, which is just the amount of the population that's lost through being eaten, essentially. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, these are all things that you could make more complicated. I mean, you know, so you could actually make that change with the level of the system. Okay. Now, it's certainly true. I mean, I think that this ecological efficiency, as it's called, is assumed by most ecologists to have an average value of about 0.1. But I think for insects, they say it's like 0.6 or something. And for mammals, 0.03, right? But we're trying to write a universal model here, and I don't think there's going to depend too much on this. Okay. And similarly, we're going to take the death rates equal. Why?
Well, yeah. Why?
Well, this is the first attempt.
Lambda, as you said.
Yeah. Varies. Well, you'll see on my last slide. You know, things to do. Okay. Vary lambda. You know, this is just the first attempt. Now, we need to generalize this to an arbitrary and varying number of species. As I say, this is just one predator and one prey. And each species, maybe predator or prey, have several predators and prey, and then we also need to model the functional response. Okay, so we need to do all of these things. So this is why we haven't looked at varying lambda. Right, so this is... So generalizing the equation is seems to be fairly easy, okay? Or at least we think we've got the right equation here. Okay, so now I've gone away from P and V to NI, and I labels the species. There's a death rate, and as I said, we've assumed the death rate of all the individuals is the same. We've scaled it out by choosing a time scale. There's this term here, okay? So this is just the food gained by so J are the prey of I. Okay, so this is the food gained by eating other species, and this is the resources lost by being eaten. So in this case, J is a predator of I. Right, so that's just the previous equation now generalized to an arbitrary number of species. So as you see, if we've taken the death rates equal and we've scaled them out, we're going to take lambda to be 0.1, although it could be in principle a parameter in our model. All we have to do really is to model this GIJ. Okay, just work out some. Okay, so, obviously there's a whole history to this. In the 1920s and 1930s, people just wrote down, so I'm now going back to the P and V to try to come up with a model of this thing. In the 1920s and 30s, people had a linear functional response. Okay, they said the more victims there are, the more that the prey will eat, essentially. Okay. So now clearly there's a saturation to this. So a popular way of putting this in was the Hollings form, which was introduced in the late 50s, that if V is large, then the predator isn't going to be able to cope with all this food. Okay, so it's going to get satiated at some stage. Okay, so for large V, this should actually curve over and go to an asymptote. Okay, so this is a form that was proposed, and you can actually derive this quite plausibly by just looking at the handling time of predators for victims. So basically, they take time to catch their victims and eat them and all the rest of it. Okay, and if you write an equation for that, then this sort of pops out. And then in the 70s, there were various other forms which were suggested. I mean, Beddington said, well, you know, not only is there time spent at catching and eating these things, but if you have predators wandering around, they'll encounter other predators and perhaps have a fight and so on. So there'll actually be time wasted doing that as well. But if you put that in, okay, now you have a term here. So this is reduced as the number of predators goes up. Okay. So we're going to take essentially a version of this, but we're not going to put this 1 in here. Okay, we're just going to have A1V over A2V plus A3P. Okay, and this is called the ratio-dependent functional response. Okay, so this is another choice. Okay, now, again, I don't want to go into this too much because there's a huge discussion in the literature amongst followers of this school and followers of the school that you don't put a 1 in there. Okay, and, well, the reason we didn't put a 1 in there is that it has nice properties, which I'll explain in a moment. But I mean, you know, this is something where, you know, there's a lot of discussion about. So I've rewritten this. This is still just one predator and one prey, but I've rewritten this in some other notation where I've replaced these numbers, A1, A2, and A3, by some other numbers here. So Sij is something I'm going to define later on. And it's a score of I against J. So this is how good I is at eating J. Okay, so this is something that's going to come out of our model later on. Okay, so this is going to be the next section. But I'll just put it here at the moment. So clearly, if I is very good at eating J, this will go up. Okay, so that's what we want. And B is some constant. Okay, so this is what we're going to take. This is still one predator and one prey. And then we need to generalize this. Why can you not absorb B in S? Well, S. Well, S is something that I'm going to define later on. I mean, it's. Well, I'm going to just write down, because I don't think I've got time to actually go into detail, how we generalize this. Okay, so this would take up about 3 or 4 transparencies. Okay, so basically what we do is if we have more, right, so here we just have one, I in this case is a predator and J is a prey. If we have more than one predator, we would obviously have terms P1, P2, P3, and so on down here. And this is what these terms are. So this is a sum over all predators, okay, of J. And this is a competition function, okay. It tells us how much K and I are in competition for each other for the prey J, all right? And something which basically we construct from our model, but basically it's proportional to how similar K and I are. Okay, so if I and K are quite similar, this is large. If I and K are not too similar, it's small. Okay, and that's because species that are similar to each other will be more in direct competition. But I haven't said how we can measure whether species are similar to each other. Okay, I haven't actually defined the similarity between species, so I have to do that in the next section. And F is what we call the efforts. This is the amount of effort that I puts into preying on J. Okay, and this you have to put in if you have a predator with more than one prey. Okay, you have to decide how much effort it's going to be putting into searching for different prey. Okay, and again, there's good theoretical reasons why that has to be in there. All right, and I don't think I've got time to go into that. Okay. And we actually then these efforts are self-consistently determined back in terms of these G's. Okay, this is the amount of effort that you put into searching for the prey. This is what you get out. This is the gain that you get out by eating it. Okay, so we think that these things should be proportional to each other for a given I. Okay, and because this is just a fraction, this normalization comes out. Anyway, I don't think I've got time to do justice to this. What I wanted to say that we have a consistent set of equations. Okay, they look quite complicated, but I think they're probably we think that they're probably the simplest that you can get away with. Okay, and they have quite a lot of nice features associated with them. So basically, we've constructed a population dynamics which is sufficiently flexible to deal with an arbitrary number of predators and prey. Okay, so this is the short time part. Okay, this is the conventional population dynamics part, and now we have to go on to the evolutionary dynamics. Okay, so that's the next section here. All right, so basically, as I said, that bit was having fixed number of species. Okay, but now we have to introduce speciation and extinction at every evolutionary time step. So this evolutionary time step were these purple dashes that I had right at the beginning. Okay, now we're going to take such a coarse-grained view that we're going to model speciation as a stochastic process. Okay, so what we're going to imagine you do is you go to a lake every 10,000 years or something, okay, and then you just observe that there's some new species has appeared there, okay, that there's perhaps some new kind of fish or something, okay, and you don't actually ask how it got there. All right, so there's no genetics in this model at all. You just say, okay, so I actually see there's a new fish there. It looks very much like this fish, so there's some kind of speciation that has occurred. So all Barbara's long discussion about all the intricacies of this are just reduced to one stochastic event. Okay, so so that's what we do there. Now, in order to actually do any of this, we actually have to define what we mean by a species. Because I've been talking about having a score, you know, one species is better than another, and I've been saying one species might be more similar to another. So I've got to actually give some kind of substructure to what a species is. If you're doing population dynamics, you can just talk about species one, species two, species three, but here we actually have to give some meaning to what a species is. So this is what we came up with. If you actually look at a description of some species in an encyclopedia or something, you know, yes, you'll come up with some description like this. And there's some key descriptors, okay? They may actually describe its behavior or some characteristics of the creature. So these are features. Okay. Now, we don't actually care too much about nocturnal, sharp teeth, and so on. So we actually replace these by numbers. All right. So, you know, if we actually gave a number to each of these, this one being 34, 76, 103, then we could just call our species by these three numbers. And that would define what we mean by the species. So what we do in general, we don't restrict ourselves just to three. We just assume that we have a whole pool of features. Okay, and in our simulations, we typically took this to be about 500, something like that. Okay, and then we just pick L, say 10 or something like that, features from this pool. Okay, and that's one species. And then we dip into the pool again and pick out another 10, and that's another 10 species. All right, so in this way, we define a species in terms of substructures.
No.
Well, you could have that. Well, okay. I mean, there's all sorts of things that you could do, right? Yeah. So, but now we have to actually say, well, how good is one species against another? And we do that by saying how good one feature is against another. So we have K by K matrix. As I said, we often take K to be 500. So let's take a 500 by 500 main matrix, M alpha beta. And that tells us how good one feature is against another. All right? So you know, sharp teeth are good against unprotected skin, all right? So that's actually a positive aspect, all right? So therefore, score has a positive entry in this matrix, you know, at the appropriate place, okay? Now, this is actually an anti-symmetric matrix. So we assume if alpha is good against beta, beta is bad against alpha, okay? And we actually, and the entries here are just taken to be random Gaussian variables with zero mean and unit variance.
Sorry, it seems like you could also define the species simply by its connectivity in the web, right? I mean, that goes back to the filter.
But how would you know how good it is against its, you know, if it's connected to...
But you could have two very different sets of attributes which give you the same position in the web. And yet you would refer to
them. Well, it'll turn out that the position of a particular species in the web isn't predetermined. I mean, it's just determined by its predator-prey relations, which is determined by this random choice, essentially. I mean...
Okay, but you could have different sets of these attributes that give you the same position as well.
So you have more than just purple.
Yeah, I get my point.
You have more than just trophic species. Well, the data is all to do with trophic species, isn't it?
Right, but in the model, it seems to me like you could wind up with a web that would have several different, collections of attributes that actually sit in the same position on the web.
Okay. I'll show you our web later on, and then you can comment at that stage about what you would have expected, okay? Okay, so the idea is that, I mean, these things, you know, whether alpha is good against beta is sort of God-given at the beginning of the simulation or the beginning of the universe. And so this is fixed, okay? And we've experimented with trying to do different things here. As I say, we don't know what to do apart from to take it to be a random matrix, but we've chosen for it to be plus ones and minus ones and so on, and it doesn't seem to make too much difference to the outcome. So we actually stick with these random Gaussian variables. And then, just concentrate on this for the moment. I mean, we determine the score of species I against species J just by summing up pairwise how good all the features belonging to I are against the features belonging to J. Okay, so we just pairwise compare them, add them all up, we divide by one of L, so this is of order one, okay? And that effectively gives us the score of I against J. The reason why there's this max here is that if this is negative, then we just replace it by zero. Okay, so we only have positive scores. So obviously, if a score is positive, I against J, it'll be negative for J against I. So we just keep the positive scores. Now, once again, I mean, you could argue there would be other ways to do this, okay? But this is just one way of doing it.
Yeah. The list of attributes would somehow order
No, there's no order.
You know, like you can get more and more expensive hardware, but it just costs you more and more to get,
I mean, we're trying the simplest thing here. I mean, we're actually trying to give some substructure to the species. We're just trying to identify them in some way, so that we can say whether something is better. Well, there aren't so much. I don't know what you mean. There's good features against. But how do you know what you want? Because I mean, what you've got, you have to also compare with what. Yeah, but it's huge, right? Yeah. Right. Yes. Yeah. But he thinks that there's. He thinks that there's a good collection of features in some way, but I mean you always have to compare features against other features, right?
What Terry, I think, is saying is that if you have a lot of good features, then maybe your birth rate will be very low. You know, the efficiency of converting from a birth, takes a lot of resources. That kind of correlation is not built in.
Okay. Well. There's a lot you can build into this model, which we haven't built in. I mean, you know, it's. We can only, I mean, you can't solve this model. You can run it on a computer, and it already runs for 2 days or something in order to actually get some results. So it's it's not you can build in. We have an external environment which is just an additional species zero. Okay. Now, so what we do, as I say, we actually run this system using the population dynamics. And then once it's reached a steady state, right, all the species with n less than 1 are got rid of, because these are the unsuccessful species. Now, once again, you may argue with this cutoff, you know, you need some cutoff which says when a species is not successful, so you actually take it out of the system. And then we do a speciation event, and the way we do it is we actually choose species at random, okay, and then we choose a feature from that species and change it to another feature. All right, so we've actually got a daughter species, or a child species, if you like, which has a parent. Okay, right. Okay, so we reduce the population size of the parent by one, and then we just have one new, one new variant of that species. Okay, and then we just again do the population dynamics, and then we do this a large number of times, 100,000 or something. Okay, so let me go to the results. So we obviously we have to do many simulations to actually, because we're going to get different results, we have to average them in some way. So we basically start off with different M matrices at the beginning, okay, and we have we have basically a different random number generator, and then there are various parameters of the model. And some of them I haven't to define. I mean, we basically have the total number of resources. So this is how much resources we actually push into the system. There's a composition parameter which I haven't defined. This is buried in this alpha thing that I mentioned. There's this B, which is just a parameter of this functional response. And there's the ecological efficiency, which in principle could be a parameter of the model. But it turns out that in order to get fairly realistic webs, you have to set it to be about 0.1 anyway, which seems to be what the ecologists like. So here are two different runs, okay. So if you like this, so this is the number of species in their system, right, with time. So this is number of ecological time steps. Okay, so in both cases, we start off with a very small number of species, and we just grow the system, right? Just have a speciation, right? And extinctions, and very, very, very slowly, the thing builds up, right? Because most of these speciations are unsuccessful. I mean, you know, the child species will be very similar to the parent species, and the parent species may already be quite well, adapted, have found a niche for itself. So the thing builds up very, very slowly, okay, and then gradually it seems to level off, but there's always an overturn of species. And you can see these are two different random numbers, so it sort of levels off at two slightly different values, okay, and this is what you'd expect. There's large fluctuations in actually growing these things. And there's no mass extinctions here. I mean, there are extinctions, but what look like mass extinctions on this time scale are actually quite gentle, okay, because this is a very long time here. No. Now, our first model actually froze. You know, the first model we had, it actually just reached a completely steady state. And you couldn't introduce any more species. Everything was so well adapted, you couldn't get any new species in there. But in this case, you have a continual overturn. And what was wrong with? Yeah, because we've introduced a more realistic population dynamics. So the population dynamics in the first paper was very, very, very simple-minded. Okay, and there were some technical points to it. We actually had to make it more realistic. And if you make it more realistic, you actually find that you do get a continual turnover.
Would you understand how this number of order 100
I think it roughly depends like the logarithm of R. Okay, that's just observation. I mean, we can't do any analytic work on this. So as you increase the number of resources, then you get more species, as you would expect. So it seems.
Yeah.
find it surprising that you get the message that you want to say.
Well, you know, there's a historical accident here, or something like this, just like in real life, you know, I mean, you know. No, no, there's a continual overturn, and most species are quite short-lived, right? I mean, no. Here's an average over 80 runs, okay, so you can see if you do an average, it sort of does roughly, you know, if you keep R fixed, asymptote to, you know, about 60 for this choice of parameters here, right? But, I mean, you know, as I said, I mean, you know, there might be some particular event that happens early on, which completely changes the history of the web, right? And so, you know, sometimes you're going to, you know, sometimes it's going to grow fairly big, and sometimes it won't. Well, let me show you the kind of webs we get. All right. So here are some typical webs. All right. Let me just tell you a few things. These represent obviously the various species. The radius of these circles is proportional to the log of the population size. All right. So these obviously are very well populated. These are basal species. Okay, next level and final level. So in this case, we just have three levels, but as I say, you do find four sometimes. Okay, and you can see various things. I mean, and also I should say that the thickness of these arrows shows how much effort is put into eating the prey. So for example, this one eats this, and this, but these lines are thicker, so it puts more effort into eating these two rather than those two. Okay. Now, the first striking thing is that most of the lines just go upwards, right? As you would expect. I mean, there's a few downwards lines, and if you look carefully, sometimes there's a few loops, but they're quite rare. Now, we haven't input this into the model. This is how it comes out. But what these things here are designed to show is what happens when you have a speciation. So this is meant to be, this is just after a speciation event, and this is after you run this thing using the population dynamics. So here you can see there's 25 species in the web. So we've introduced a new species called 26, which is a speciation of species 1. Okay, and after you run the population dynamics, What you see is that 26 has survived and prospered even, all right? And various things have happened. For example, whereas here, so this was being eaten by 7, 8, 9, and 10. Okay, now 7 and 10 have swapped to, are still eating 1, whereas 8 and 9 have now swapped to eating 26. So this is actually a fairly kind of standard speciation event. I mean, we can understand, you know, what goes on, and we can actually kind of rationalize it. Here's another speciation event, which is a bit harder to understand. I mean, you know, if you think about it, you can probably understand it, but I mean, you know, this is more surprising. So here we've speciated 11, and there's 26 there, okay? And then we sort of run it forward, and these things in black have disappeared. So 4 has disappeared, 5 has shrunk, and actually some of these, 24 has gone extinct, and also 16 or 15 has gone extinct. Okay, so this is a slightly more complex event. There's several extinctions, and it, you know, it takes a little bit more thought to actually see why this happens. Okay, but in general, if you look at these things, they all make sense. I mean, you know, well, that's not obvious, actually. I mean, you know, we've actually formulated these equations in a very abstract way. So we could have run this thing, and, you know, we could have got some complete garbage out. Yeah. Well, what now? What does that? I don't know what stability means in this context. Well, what we've done is we've actually killed a substantial number of these. I mean, like suppose of this, you know, 90 species, and we've destroyed 25%, right? So assuming that there's some meteor event or something, right? And then all that happens is it just grows again, right? It's quite stable. I think it's quite difficult to destroy these things. Well, you have to perturb them in some. I mean, you want to perturb them in some way. Is that right? Or? Okay. Right. No. Well, I mean, I'm not quite sure what you mean. I mean, they look neat because they've actually been. I mean, obviously they had to be sorted. I mean, you know, if you just try to randomly plot them, I mean, there'd be arrows all over the place. So, Chris wrote a computer program to make, you know, to obviously put. To minimize the number of crossovers so that they actually looked like, you know, webs. So that's why they look attractive. But I'm not sure what you're talking about, the random matrix. I mean, there is the only random matrix is M, which is this random matrix for the features. From that, we construct a random matrix for the scores. So that tells us what's the predator of what. There's also this these efforts, okay, which may be zero. So it may be formally you have Sij is positive, but a particular species may put no effort into looking for another species. So there's quite a few ingredients as well. But this is far from random. See, this is my main point. I mean, if you look back in the literature in the 70s, May, for example, we talked about food web, postulated a random graph. This is about as far away as you can get from that as possible. And his deduction was that as you have more complex systems, they become less stable. Okay, and that he deduced from the theory of random matrices, which is clear. I think it's just garbage, right? I mean, you know, you don't expect these things to be random. They're highly evolved. So this is very far from a random matrix, right? It's been very, very carefully evolved according to realistic population dynamics. So.
About your figure at the bottom right, this very well defined segregation of predators and prey, so that a very well defined group of predators feeds on a certain prey and other groups don't. And there's very little.
What do you mean? Like there's typically three or something, or three to five? Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Does that agree with
similar to
721? No, but if you take the real data and
well,
also
let me show you. Yeah.
Well, maybe you're going to do that.
Well, I'm going to show you. So this is a picture, right? So let me actually show you. I mean, there's obviously, you know, so obviously now we have some, this is some data. And I mean, this is a kind of, you know, only a fraction of what we get. All I wanted to show you was that, you know, typically our numbers aren't too bad, right? I mean, you know, with these particular values, okay, now I haven't actually explained too carefully what all these parameters are. This is a competition parameter that, you know, you actually get For this particular choice, you know, roughly 1% of top species, you know, about 10% basal species, and so on. And I think our links per species is rather low. But apart from that, our numbers aren't too bad. I mean, when you just compare them with the data out there. Okay.
Links per species being low, some one of the intermediate level ones, how do you get it so low? I mean, only the top ones don't have the weight.
I don't know whether it's actually low. It's low compared to the data, but you know, I don't know how good the data is.
1% top species, how do you get the weight per species being low at 1.59? Every intermediate bottom. Well, one species only have one weight, but you don't count what they.
No. I'll take that as a lull in the argument to go on. So you could have all sorts of things. You can ask, you know, supposing you have a speciation, what happens? Okay, so I've shown you two examples of what happens. In one case, the child species survived, and in the other case, it was very, very complicated. Okay, lots of things went extinct. So this is basically tells you what happens. Okay, so an addition is when the child species survives and nothing else goes extinct, and that happens 4% of the time. Okay, this is just a simple substitution where the child replaces the parent, but nothing else happens. Okay, that happens 2% of the time. Okay, and no change where the thing goes extinct immediately because everything else is so well adapted. That happens most of the time, about 90% of the time that happens. And the other 4% is more complicated events like I haven't. Okay, so you just this is the speciation. Okay, so you just take a random species, okay, and change one of the features. Okay, so the child is basically the same as the parent, apart from one feature is different. So it's quite closely related. I mean, particularly it'll be in quite strong competition with the parent. Okay, and this shows you basically the extinction rate and the rate of origins, and they roughly balance. Okay, so this is why it takes so long to build up a food web, because basically, you know, it takes a long, long time to build up the numbers because these things balance so carefully. Well, that's something else. I mean, we've hardly tried to change those. I agree. I mean, you can, and I mean, right at the end again, I have a list of things to do. So this will be something else that we have to do. So this is basically okay. So here is supposing that a parent on level 2 has a child. Okay, on what level will the child be? Okay. Very unlikely it'll be on level 1, most likely it'll be on level 2, some likelihood it'll be on level 3, and unlikely to be on level 4. Okay, so as you see here, it's most likely that the child is on the same level, exists on the same level as a parent, which isn't too surprising because they're very similar. Only thing is here, there's a slight, I mean, level 4 there's a very precarious existence on level 4. You know, when you're right at the top of the food chain, there's very small population numbers, and so it's very easy, you know, to go extinct there. So basically, life is quite hard on level 4. It's also quite hard on level 1. Okay. Now, how am I? Well, let's continue for a while. Well, there's also, I mean, the point is, you know, there's all sorts of things here that you can continue doing. So what this is saying is, supposing a species goes, a newly created species survives, what's the relationship between this species and any other species that go extinct as a consequence? Oh, and we've actually, you know, so this is basically the probability of this happening. Okay, so obviously here's the probability. So there's a quite high probability that the parent goes extinct, which again is not too surprising because the parent and the child are very closely related. Also true with competitors in general. Okay, so I don't want to get to belabor these points too much, but you can study all of these things and actually see get these numbers. Okay, so perhaps I should start to conclude. The main thing is that this model covers a large number of timescales. From the very short, which I haven't had time to describe. I mean, these FIJs that I've hardly had time to describe relate to foraging strategies. So they happen on a very, very short timescale, to the very long timescale, and you have where you have the evolutionary dynamics. And in order to actually get these things to a balance, in order to actually get a steady state, where steady is in inverted commas, because you have a continual overturn of species, you have to wait a very, very long time, of the order of 50,000 or 100,000 of these evolutionary time steps. We think, anyway, the results are intuitively appealing, and when you actually look at these food webs and actually look how they change, they seem to change in some way that's intuitively appealing, and also the results are in agreement with this food web data for real ecosystems. Further work. Okay, there's lots of things to do. I should say in our defense that I haven't seen a model like this in the literature. So this is, there's not many models like this. So you basically try to do what's the simplest model to start with. But there's all sorts of refinements that you can put in. Okay, so here are some of the ones that have already been mentioned. Vary lambda with the level, that could be done. You could have a variable number of features. All right, so we've had a fixed number of features, but you could start with a small number of features and just add one occasionally and see if that was a good thing to do. Okay, if it was a bad thing, the thing would go extinct. If it was a good, then it would grow. And you could ask, where were the species with the most features in the food web? There's also different types of resources. I mean, I haven't discussed really what the resources are, but you can put, kind of different kinds of biomass in there, and you could have kind of dead organic matter, which is fed back into the food chain and all sorts of things like this. I haven't put immigration into the model, okay, which is very important. There's no spatial variation. You could have kind of two islands, or you could have a mainland and an island, and you could grow, different communities on both and interact them together and see what happened. Distribution of sizes of extinction events. Well, it's not a power law, but I mean, that's about it. The nature of the stationary state, as Bernard said, it's not a conventional stationary state. I mean, it's a continual overturn of species there. But it comes.
There simply can be a set of species which are stable to any single future change.
Well, it's just a new set of. I mean, there's a continual overturn of species. It's a new species.
Why do you like every overturn of species? You only change one feature at a time with new species. So some combination of species could be stable to any single.
Well. We don't know. I mean, that seems to me highly unlikely, but I mean. Right, exactly. I'll just finish. I mean, you mentioned environmental changes. Okay, so you would like to see, if it's stable to environmental changes, whatever that means.
Your very first level, but these are not being eaten by it, or whatever you call it. So right. The distribution, well, that's like your boundary condition.
So you would like to perturb the basal species in some way? Okay.
Whatever, but suppose that changes, how?
Yeah, you can ask that if you want. And there's probably many more questions left that people can think of. Anyway, so I'll stop there.
Your model
everything. The question is, is everything a helium? And my question is there in principle a way to experimentally determine this dimensionality from real feedback? I have an idea of how we can do that.
Really? Well, you can tell me then.
if let's say one species eats two other species, mm-hmm. and let's say a wolf eats rabbits and birds, mm-hmm. and then the fox eats rabbits, what are the chances that the fox will eat two birds? In a way, that's kind of elementary loop. And if your dimensionality of features is very small, then there will be much more of those loops than
maybe. I'm not sure how seriously you should take some of these concepts. I think you can try to map these things too much into the real world. But I agree. I mean, one thing that we have to do is probably see how sensitive this model is to various changes. So we have to change the form of this GIJ. I've obviously changed the number of features and so on. And my guess is from the experience with the first model that a lot of these results are quite robust against changes, because there we had a completely different form of population dynamics. And although the system froze in the end, the results for the food webs were not too different from the results in a much more sophisticated model. So I think I'd like to postulate, as long as the population dynamics is roughly correct, as long as it has the right qualitative features, it's not going to matter too much what precise form one takes and so on. And I think that's also true within the number of features. I mean, I think as long as it's large enough, I think it's not going to matter too much.
Yeah, maybe it should be just large enough so that the number of possible features is much larger than the number of features.
Yeah. Well, clearly that's not true, then it's not going to work. Yeah.
I'm still intrigued by the structure of the network. I'm curious how many of these features, two in particular that seem to stand out, are actually evident in the empirical data. It seems that as you go higher in the web, you can actually feed on more traffic. So in other words, you look
I don't think so. I think typically these things had three or four prey, and at the top level, and I think three or four down.
It's a question of how they were organized. Maybe they were organized primarily by the first level, how you group them. But it also looks like there's fewer basal. Lower in the web, there's fewer species.
Yes.
Is that realistic?
Well, I gave you the number of. I mean, you want to know the percentage of species in level one and level two and so on. Is that? I think if I remember correctly, that it's in line with the real data. Certainly, the number of basal species, the number of top species is. Well, I'm not quite sure what you're getting at. I mean, certainly you don't see many. Well, you don't see many specialists. I mean, you don't see many that have just one prey, right? And that's presumably because that's not a very good thing to do. Well,
because there was, it looked like
typically
on level one, had.
Typically they had three or four. I thought.
Level with those people up there.
Well, let's see if I can find this thing again.
I mean, there's very light arrows crossing between level and group.
So, well, I mean, here you have typically, this is like four and so on, and you have the same number down here. I don't know. I mean, as I say, it's very rare that you actually find just a species which just feeds on one prey.
Well, okay. Upper left, the first three on the left, the more than half of the guys in that level are connected to only one below. Yeah.
Sorry.
7, 8, 9, 12, 11.
Oh, I see. Okay, this is just.
19, 20, 21.
Yeah.
We still have a very full morning, so but we have the whole afternoon free, so
all right, okay.
We have a 10-minute break.
Okay.